Code Monkey, get up, get coffee. Code Monkey, go to job. Code Monkey, have boring meeting with boring manager Rob. Rob say Code Monkey very diligent, but his output stink. His code not functional or elegant. What do Code Monkey think?
Hello and welcome to From Python Import Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Chris Miller, and I am here with a veritable plethora of Python developers. Why don't we go around the table and just introduce yourselves so people can hear your voices.
Hello, David Stanek.
Oh, Dan Buck.
Mike Crute.
Ben Smith.
Mike Piernot, apparently talking over Dave Stanek. Sorry, Dave.
It's okay, we'll take it out in post. Not really. Wanted to talk a little bit about 2010's PyOhio. We all, some of us went, some of us didn't. Some of us had a good time. Some of us went to PyOhio. Some of us had a good time not at PyOhio. Some of us are looking very sad.
I didn't get to go again. Third year in a row, very sad. So hopefully everybody can fill me in on all the awesome stuff that happened.
So I guess I just want to open it up with how many years, first of all, how many years has PyOhio been going on? Is this the third year?
3 years.
All right. And how many years have people here gone? This was my first year.
This was my second year.
Okay.
This is my second year. I missed the second year, so, or last
Ditto.
Year.
So. Okay. I was able to go to all three of them.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
venue to venue to venue.
What did you think just overall about this year? It was in a slightly different venue. It was on the Ohio State campus in the Ohio Union.
This year was great. Last year, it felt like we were holding it in a cave.
Well, where was it held last year?
It was in, I think, the architecture building. I don't know. That's as close as I can get. I don't know the campus.
Yeah, some architecture building at OSU. It was kind of wacky, though, because it was really big. You had to, like, walk around to go to different places, and it was just, there's just so much there.
Well, it was a lot of dead space. I mean, the ceilings were very high, and there were ramps all over the place, and
stairs, and
way too much dead space.
If you're, the library, though, was kind of spread out as well, because we had tracks going on in different places. Well.
Yeah. But no one actually left the main room, because you had to go upstairs to go to
the exactly. Everything was there at the top of the stairs that wasn't in the main conference room. But, yeah, I think it is definitely an improvement over the library, because I feel like everybody's kind of closer together, kind of like at a PyCon, not spread out in two different spaces.
That's exactly what came to mind to me was just, you know, how many people were there, kind of, and because it was a smaller space, everyone was talking to one another instead of spreading out and logging into the Wi-Fi, which is what normally happens when you've got a big spread out area.
It kind of encouraged you to go to talks too a little bit more because, you were right there. I mean, you didn't like it, you just walk around the corner and boom, you're in another talk. So that was kind of cool.
The round room needs a little help.
I know, Catherine already apologized for that. It's like, My bad for thinking the round room would be a nice thing. I think it would have been okay had it been set up a little differently, but having the podium on one side and pretty much everybody sitting on the opposite side and having the screen up somewhere wildly different, like you couldn't even really gesture at what you were presenting and engage the audience. So
it was a tricky room, and the fact that it was a set of tiered steps instead of chairs and tables, you know, people were whipping out the laptops and, you know, following along as best they could, but I know in Catherine Devlin's Bug Fixing, that became something of a small issue. I mean, mostly people were following along on the screen and listening to Catherine and listening to the discussion, so it worked out okay. But in some of them, it was definitely an issue.
This was like a room in the round, like Theater in the Round kind of setup?
You know, even with Theater in the Round, you have... Well,
structure.
Okay.
This was a set of stairs, pretty much. You know,
okay.
A set of 18-inch high steps, mm-hmm. and then a speaker, and then a screen up above.
I can imagine it being there for like a small band or orchestra practicing.
Right. It would have been good for a music.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, something like the keynote at PyCon a couple years ago that Steve Holden ran interview style with the creator of BitTorrent. That might play well in that kind of space.
I can see that being actually using all of the seating. But
or
for this presentation
panel.
With like you know, speaker audience, it was awkward. Mm. I'll say that as a speaker, I was really pleased that at the last minute my talk got moved from that room into a more traditional, like, hey, here's your screen, here's your podium, here's your people. That was, it was a much more comfortable space being in that classroom setting.
Yeah, I felt really comfortable in that setting. I mean, I had a total of like 10 people there, but
what the hell?
But it was
more like 40.
So how many of you guys had talks?
I think all of us.
I didn't do a talk. I decided I would just go this year without doing too much else, just so I could experience it. Next year, I may give a talk on something wacky.
It would be cool.
Yeah, Mike didn't have a scheduled talk.
I didn't have a talk.
Yeah. Make the deadline.
I had the average amount of attendees in my room, though.
You missed it by, what, about 2 months?
Only.
Yeah, but your Unicode talk, yours and Len Thomas's Unicode talk, was good. I mean, people who attended it seemed to appreciate it. I tried to record it and had an equipment fail. But
it certainly went off better than our first two rehearsals.
Well, yeah.
The Kleppy one was good, though.
Kleppy one was good, yeah.
So, as speakers, Ben, Dan, Mike, well,
Ninja
sort of. How did you feel about the whole process, submitting your talks, and you know, any feedback that people got to you, and you know, kind of the organization that day, that kind of thing? I don't want to be ripping on anybody that, you know, I mean, several of us were staff or semi-staff.
Well, we can rip on Crude, right?
We can rip on Crude.
There you go, for not submitting.
So, I mean, how was the whole experience of being a speaker at BioHub?
In disclosure,
right.
I was the main person for the organizing yes. speakers, and Crude was on the talk
and
submission.
And
as was Chris.
Yeah, I was also on the program committee.
So half of us.
Full disclosure. So when we didn't talk to you at all, what was the process like, and how did you?
Well, I got some thoughts on that. I thought it was really simple, but maybe, I don't know. I was the one person that had the one sentence description of my talk, and I think that maybe next year we should have a little bit more stringent requirements on abstracts.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, the process was perfect. You submitted your talk, and you know, you were notified promptly that your talk was accepted. So I mean, the day of the talk, the audio crew, which is the same couple of guys from PyCon,
mm-hmm. Carl Carson's crew.
Yeah, exactly. They were provided from the PSF, if I recall correctly. Does it sound right?
Mm-hmm.
They were really cool. You know, I got in there and got you hooked up to the mics and whatnot really easily. It was a smooth process. So
cool. How about when you were putting it together, Dave? I mean, you were heading up that committee. Was there anything that you were looking for in a talk that if someone wanted to submit for next year, that, you know, things that, you know, definitely wouldn't have gotten in, or things that you were definitely, I mean, well, something that you were looking for? Is there anything that would set, you know, submitting to PyOhio apart from submitting to PyCon or any other PyCon?
I think the big difference is that we would like more beginner type talks,
mm-hmm.
because not every, like at PyCon, you go to PyCon and almost everybody there is, you know, a core committer or has a Python project in the open source world, or
mm-hmm.
they're very into the culture. Whereas at PyOhio, there's a lot of people there that don't do Python day to day. They're interested in Python. We had one whole track of tutorial type things,
mm-hmm.
but it would have been nice to have some more beginner material around other concepts. Because most of the people submitting talks are like hardcore hacking into this thing, and there's not a lot of, you know, intro to this other stuff.
Now that makes me laugh, because our comments on PyCon were, boy, I wish there were less beginner talks and more expert talks.
I think it's the difference of conferences, though, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at most of the people I talked to at PyOhio were like .NET guys with the insurance agencies,
mm-hmm.
or Java guys with the banking industry, and a lot of a lot more of those kind of people tended to come to PyOhio than
mm-hmm.
hardcore Python guys.
Hobbyist.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think PyCon would make sense with less newbie stuff. And PyOhio probably makes sense with more, just given your different
spot. It does make sense. I know, I can't remember her name now. Did a talk on Iron Python. There was a lot
Sarah
of...
Saduki.
Yes. I met her briefly in line. There was a lot of buzz about Iron Python, and it may have just been because of the number of .NET developers there.
Yeah,
I know we're probably not the crew to talk about Iron Python.
They're doing it because it's a brush of fresh air. You know?
Right.
They're doing it because it's as close as they can get to the magic of Python.
Well, plus, Saduki's talk is really good. I mean, she's given it a lot, and she knows her stuff, so she kind of has a way to energize people with that.
So what did people attend? What things really jumped out at you? And let's just kind of go around. I'll start with Mike. Wait, no.
Hey, this is where you can all make me feel really bad.
What do you wish you had attended?
Okay.
The Coens talk. I really wish I would have seen Greg.
The Coens talk was... Yeah, I was there for that. And the Coens talk was less of a talk and more of a sit and do. And basically what they did is they gave you either a USB stick or you pulled it down from the Git repo. And does everyone know what the Coens are? I mean, maybe I should explain what they're based off of the Ruby Coens. They're a set of basically tests that you run the test, you run the script to run the test. It tells you that there's something wrong, and you go in, and in the comments of the code, it takes you from the very basic of here's a string, here's an int, here's a list, that kind of thing. It takes you all the way up through, generators and, using lambdas properly and that kind of thing. You learn about Python by correcting tests in Python. And I thought it was really interesting because, I've never gone through, I don't know if you guys have, kind of gone through an organized, simple to advanced stage of playing with the language. And it reminded me of things like just the stuff about list slicing and the things you can do with lists. There are things we do with lists every day and there are things that we forget that you can do with them. And it was just interesting to find those hidden, dusty corners and nooks and crannies that I don't get to very often. So I took a lot of... Actually, his repo is up on GitHub. I forked it already so I could sit and play with it. And it's good stuff. It's something that I'll probably use. I think it's... I honestly feel like it'd be one of those things that would be good for just any developer to start playing with once a year. Just sit down when you've got some time in a coffee shop and just...
Nice exercise.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly it. It reminded me of the katas that you were running here, Dave.
It's got a nice feel because you kind of have some scaffolding where you're not going to completely fall down.
Right.
And it kind of hints you where to go next and what to learn.
Yeah, it does. So
it's
that
a great
was.
Idea.
I thought that 2 hours was a bit much. I left after the first hour just because I sort of gotten the point and realized, I can take this with me.
Kind of a choose-your-own-adventure anyhow.
Yeah. The way that the script ran, though, it ran things in order, so you couldn't just jump ahead. Which was I thought could be valuable. And something like, I would have liked to have had that to hand our interns when they started here.
That's actually a fantastic idea.
Not just interns,
anybody who hasn't done Python before.
Right,
because
yeah.
Bring on a job again into the Python.
We rarely bring on anybody who has already worked with Python professionally. So
I may actually consider holding a quick intro to it with our operations guys.
I'd be up for helping with that if you want.
We have we have tons of Python in our environment, more than I think some of our other operations folks realize.
Mm-hmm.
I think that'd be kind of cool.
All right, veering away from the work subject again.
Can you maybe think of something with the lab setting that had, the lab-ish setting for the Coens?
What do you mean?
That, well, I guess just that it was follow along and do.
And
that I was missing that in some of the talks. I can't even name one right offhand right now, but I guess I just, this is after having been to OSCON a couple weeks ago, thank you, employer, that some of the talks were really, really wanted to have, everybody wanted to have a table and then power strips everywhere because it made a lot of sense to follow along and to have a tutorial type session.
Sure.
And it's almost like I kind of would want PyoHive to grow that track of lab style tutorials.
I think there's plenty of room for that to grow. I agree. I mean, when I went to Google Code, Google I/O a couple years ago. And it was the same kind of thing where there were talks, but there was also a lot of lab-type stuff. And, you learn from both. I find that it's always... I love to see it work out in both directions. So you have a little bit of a talk, and then you begin to work, and then people just kind of help one another out.
So there's what people need to submit next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we are.
Tutorial.
That's a good one. Something that fell down in some of the talks at Powwow was the lack of power. So yeah, that's a note for next year, is that more power strips on more rows.
Well, to be fair, they did request everyone bring some power strips.
Absolutely, they did. Yeah.
I know I didn't.
Yeah, I know I didn't either.
I feebed out.
I didn't release. I know Suzuki brought some of that.
So what else did people attend that they liked?
Genetic programming.
Yes. Happy.
How was that? It was okay. This is Eric Flair, who did the genetic programming in Python. First of all, it was very humorous, but not overly humorous. So like, he had the nice balance of, you know, jokes mixed in with information, but a lot of really interesting ideas to have to think about. So I mean, in a lot of ways, this is just a reflection of how we usually work anyway. We have, you know, we try a solution and you know make it work, then make it right, then make it perform. And essentially, it's those three steps inside a library of its own that will do the generation, it'll do the multiplication of generations and retesting of fitness and all the things that are more like pure evolutionary concepts,
mm-hmm,
within code. And a lot of the skill comes down to being able to reduce your problem to a really simple mathematical operation, and that's hard. I don't know. I thought it was really interesting the way that the one project he mentioned was PyGenome, I think it was, or
yeah, so it's PyGenome. I actually downloaded it, installed it, and I'm playing with it. It's an
interesting idea.
No, PyEvolve. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting too, and I actually found I liked the idea of using a program to generate an efficient algorithm. And I thought that was interesting, and I could think of several places with certain kinds of monitoring that are done by $employer that I'd like to see us run that data through something like that and see what we come up with. It would just be very interesting. I you know, with something like genetic programming, it's an interesting talk to go to, but so sometimes I find that these very interesting talks are things that I will never actually be able to practically use. I'll tell myself I'll come up with my own project for it, but either I lack the time or the data, you know, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I found that this was something that I could walk away with, was something useful, which was great.
Speaking of practical talks, I kind of liked the log processing talk.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, with Scott McCarty.
Yeah. He has really a lot of really novel ideas on how to... especially awesome concept is the whole artificial ignorance, mm-hmm, and trying to reduce the volume of information to something that's a little bit more parsable by a human.
I really liked that term, artificial ignorance. I'd never heard that before. So.
Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. Well, so the idea is that you have a lot of log files with a lot of garbage in them, a lot of things that sets each line apart, IP addresses, PIDs, machine names. And the artificial intelligence algorithms look at those log lines and try to reduce that. So, for example, if you have IP addresses in your log lines, it'll just reduce them to a couple of hash marks. So then when you get to the end of all your logs and aggregate that, things that are similar, regardless of the noise, all kind of roll up together.
Oh, nice.
It's a very, very nice idea. Really liked it.
I got a lot out of that one. I rather enjoyed your talk, Dan. I did.
Yes.
I did. Well, I honestly thought, I originally wasn't going to go because I thought I had to know a lot more C. Because I thought you were talking about something very, I thought you were talking about dealing with things on that level, not dealing with the standard libraries and stuff, which is someplace that I could.
Or the docs.
Or the docs, yes. So, you know, I took away a number of things from yours, and I actually started to, that night at the subway, when we were able to find some Wi-Fi, started to go through and look at, you know, what kind of documentation is needed, what kind of, you know, what the bugs actually are, and just realizing, hey, you know, this is something that I could do and not have to commit hours and hours and hours every week to it. So you could easily pick up some of those easier bugs and just pump them out.
And they have an easy tag. So you can,
yes, I love that. That made me very happy. The easy tag was like, oh, awesome.
Okay, I have a tremendously dumb question at this point,
sure,
and it may be because I've completely spaced out earlier on, but what's your talk, Dan?
Intro to core involvement.
Ah, see,
yes.
I had not heard those words today.
And it
today.
Was
I
was not
right.
Intro to core development, which is something that, I mean, people who are asking, like, oh, you're doing the intro to core development talks. Like, well, no, I chose that word intentionally because I strongly believe that you do not need to be a developer to contribute to core Python. And
he's right. And again, I almost didn't go because I thought, oh, he's going to be talking way above my head. I have no idea it was done. And it wasn't. It was right there, right where I live every day. So I thought that was really worth it. And then there was the, again, the side talk that we had on diversity, which will be later in this episode, diversity in the Python community, that came up a couple of times. So that was worthwhile.
Are there slides or video or recording slides of any of this?
It was
my slide. Yeah, it was all recorded, so it's going to be on a blip at some point, like it was last year.
Probably pretty soon.
My slides are available. I've got links everywhere. I mean, there's no need to say it here.
Computer overlord will insert the appropriate links where necessary.
There we go.
That will be in post. I found it really useful because just the simple tip of making myself nosy on stuff that was kind of interesting to me was extremely beneficial. Now I get emails about issues where I think I could actually provide value at some point in time. And I can kind of watch how things progress. Instead of just like that top-level view, the static view of what happened just now, I can kind of watch it over time and see how people interact with each other and how maybe I can start interacting with those same people. It's very interesting.
I can't reiterate enough the idea that you don't... How can I put it? I marvel at the number of projects that people in this room take on. I think maybe Mike, you may be here with me because we have a lot of time commitments and, you know, stuff like that. And just marvel at how much people are working on at any given time. And when I hear that you guys are, you know, doing things on the standard libraries or taking your open source project here or doing this or doing that, you know, the picture in my head is, God, they get out of here at work and they walk 10 feet and they put the laptop on and they go until 2 in the morning. And the truth is that isn't the case, and that's not the case. And it's so easy to think that to be involved with the core, you need to be insane developer guy.
Yeah.
But the reality is that the community is made up of a bunch of people given a few hours at a time. And that all you need to do is put your foot in it.
Well, that's the important thing, is that like by making yourself nosy on bugs and by lurking on the list and watching, you kind of get a feel for it before you actually start diving into it. Because otherwise you dive into it, you don't really know what's going on, you get discouraged very quickly, and then you get back out.
Mm-hmm.
This, you kind of gently get into it.
So did anyone do the sprints?
No.
I'm sorry, Mike.
I was there for 2 hours late night.
Yeah, like I went right after. I went to the subway right as we were setting up, and
I couldn't find him. I knew it wasn't the subway across the street, and I walked up and down looking for a subway until someone tweeted me the address.
Bid Dancer, or rather David Murray, he was available for all the sprints. I think he said he was going to go to them. We had a,
I know,
we
were saying Saturday.
We had a core developer, our core committer present.
Yes, so we went to lunch with him that day.
Right.
Yes. And actually talking to him was interesting too, just listening to the conversation. That was pretty fascinating. So other random thoughts?
Well, the sprints turned out really well.
Mm-hmm.
People haven't reported back on the stats yet, but there's at least 12 core Python bugs that we've committed patches, tests, or documentation for.
Oh, fantastic. Bravo.
I know other people working on other projects besides just core Python, so I think it was pretty productive.
That's very cool.
So there was one other talk that I really kind of liked. It was a bait and switch talk.
Oh, really?
Ben's talk on Splunk that was like 8 minutes of Splunk and then 40 minutes of DevOps.
Yeah, pretty much.
And the discussions that spawned afterwards were it was kind of a cool talk.
Okay. I couldn't stay until Sunday because of time commitments and stuff. So why don't you tell a little bit about your talk so that those of us here that...
Can I make a quick comment?
Sure. Out.
So your one sentence abstract you couldn't even stick to?
That's right.
So what was the talk supposed to be about?
Okay, so... And I'll explain to you what I explained to everybody at the talk is I actually went into it with the idea of... I didn't know anything about the Splunk API or SDK and wanted to use this as an opportunity to learn. So effectively, I got in there and realized that it's really crappy. And not a big fan of the code or the implementation. So basically talked about it in basics for a few minutes and then moved on to nicer things. And but... I did at least. I have at least started a project to try to make it better. So, and hopefully, I'll push it up and get some involvement there from other developers in the Splunk community, because the Splunk actually has a really vibrant community, and they use the Stack Overflow app for their question Q&A kind of thing. So that's kind of nice. And then if I can get some involvement there, and maybe Splunk will get off their ass and realize that their stuff sucks. But
so can you say why it sucks?
Yeah, well, just the API is really confusing. In that it's kind of got this, well, for one, it's got this one monolithic method that just, it's called dispatch, and it just,
ew,
you give it a string with a giant list of, giant dictionary of arguments, and it goes and does a bunch of crap.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
You have one do stuff method.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I've never seen code like that before.
Yeah, do everything. Exactly. I mean, I'm sure, I know at least one point in my life I've done that too, but it's really ugly, and I don't like ugly code, and I don't condone using ugly code, so I moved on from talking about Splunk to talking about some of our one of our internal tools that we use here for basically managing, you know, nearly 1,000 servers that we have here, and touched on that a little bit, and that kind of got some ideas going in the group about other operations style things we can do with Python, and I think they spawned off in open space. I don't know whatever came of it, but
it ended up being Fabric, and it wasn't nearly as awesome as I hoped it would be.
Right.
But I think there's a follow-up kind of DevOps thing going on in Cleveland sometime soon.
Scott and I had talked briefly about that, but we'll talk about it another time.
Yeah, I'd like to delve maybe in another episode about the whole DevOps thing,
sure,
because it's an interesting...
I think it's remarkably useful, especially for these admins that, you know, you may only have 2 dozen servers, but automation can help you, and Python can help you automate.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's a really relevant topic.
Yeah, I mean, Python's the next best thing. You know, if you can't use Perl, use Python.
Even if you can use Perl.
All right, what do you say we take a little break?
Yeah, I heard you guys did some interviews. Should we queue one of those up?
Yeah, let's queue up our interview with Dan, and we'll be back after that.
Awesome.
So I'm here with Dan Book. Dan is one of the other Pythonistas that we work with. But more importantly, here at PyOhio, he was presenting on how to contribute to the Python core. But we're not going to talk about that because his presentation's up on Scribd and you can view it up there. And he's more than happy to talk about that, I think, separately. But he pounded on a particular point that I think we'd like to delve into a little bit more, is the push for diversity inside the Python community. Now, I remember at PyCon, we heard a bit about this, but it was a bit generic. It wasn't really kind of taking hold. And we weren't entirely certain what that meant.
Yeah.
Because diversity is it's a big word, but mm-hmm. I mean, it's a big concept. Mm-hmm. So what are you talking about when you talk about inspiring more diversity in the Python community?
I guess, let's qualify this.
Okay.
White man talking to a white man.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
We white men here, typically, I shouldn't say typically, historically in the sciences and in computer science and whatever, let's not even talk about the fact that early programmers were women in a lot of cases. That's leave
Ada.
Out. Ada, exactly. But recently, at least, in the last 50 years, they've lost ground. Women have lost ground in particular. And I'm saying women because if we even start talking about socioeconomic and racial minorities, then it's just going to get even worse. Like, you don't want to think about that. It's just bad. But in our particular field, the situation we've ended up with is... men inspiring younger generations of men to take this mantle up early, and you know they young boys become obsessed with machines and computers and programming and all this stuff at a crazy early age, and the same thing just isn't happening with girls. And I guess what I mean by inspiring diversity, clearly my talk was about core involvement.
Right, right.
But I didn't really get to delve into what I really meant by that. Thank you for asking. So diversity is what we're trying to do in the software community today, and this is not just me. There's lots of other people who started years before I got interested in it, is changing the conversation from it being about doing this out of guilt to doing this because we want better software. And
how does diversity lead to better software?
Okay, so you and I are sitting here talking, and actually there are three silent observers in the room right now.
More white men.
Yep, all of us, five white dudes, you know, various hair lengths,
We're pale.
Yes,
dudes
there you go.
In front of laptops.
Roughly the same build, you know.
No, I think there's a spectrum.
Yes, I would venture to say that our life experiences, compared to the life experiences of all human beings alive on the planet today, are roughly the same. And I would say that the way we grew up, the language we use, the way we use our language, the way that we think about tools, the way we think about software, mm-hmm. I'd say that it's, you know, we might think that we have strong opinions and that we debate and all that crap, but roughly we are all thinking the same way. We're thinking the same way. We're feeling the same way. We're instilling all of these same things in the software that we write. And I think because of that, we're completely missing a huge spectrum of end users. Mm-hmm. So I guess there was a recent talk I got to see at OSCON. Anna Martelli Ravenscroft, who is one of the co-authors of the Python cookbook, I believe.
Okay.
Her husband, Alex Martelli, is a core committer.
Right.
But she did a wonderful talk on using diversity as a core dependency of your software projects, you know, roadmap, whatever you want to call it. And so, again, this is changing the conversation from being like, well, we got to make sure that we have diversity hires because that's the right thing to do. It's like, no, you got to make sure that you have people with different life experiences so that you write software that connects with more users more effectively.
So, you know, that's interesting because in the past, and I know especially, you know, we all five white men here are all different ages as well. So we go back, some of us go back a little bit further, some of us, but, you know, I know that when I got started, you know, software was meant to be used one way. It's very much a, you know, an SAP, very German sort of, you know, you will do it my way or insolence will be punished. And so are we going for software being able to react to more situations or just being more inclusive in general to make it more broadly instinctual?
Well, that's one argument. I guess I want to make sure that I don't come out of this saying that there's only one argument for why diversity is good for software.
Right.
I think it's good because it lets us potentially connect with more end users more effectively. But I think the thing that I'm really interested in personally is having people think about stuff differently so that we can come up with different solutions that we would not otherwise have been able to come up with being a bunch of dudes with the same life experiences sitting in a room together. I'm interested in having brainstorming sessions with people who have arrived at software development from different paths than myself. And
I think it's good. I'm going to play devil's advocate.
Please, please.
You know, if I'm if I were a woman... Okay, let's not go there. Okay,
nice.
Do you has there been any blowback from the female community, let alone racial, social, economic, of going, oh, you bunch of white men, oh, you mean well,
yeah,
but you're going about this completely wrong. Why don't you ask us? Why don't you? I mean,
why don't you ask us exactly?
Is the diversity thing coming from a bunch of white dudes, or is it actually coming from, you know, the smaller part of the community that wants to grow their part of
the community?
It's
a little bit of both. Yeah. I mean, like, you definitely have you have some men who arrive at this out of guilt and mm-hmm. then learn how to think about it in a more healthy way and then mm-hmm. foster it. And so, like, example, there's a wonderful book that I'm really in the beginning of reading, which is kind of embarrassing because it's only like 200 pages. It's the Unlocking the Clubhouse.
Okay.
And I'll get a reference or whatever the heck we can put in there. But it was done by two folks who work at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And one of whom was a man who was the associate dean of the school of something or other. I can't remember. I'm going to misquote and misinform. Anyway, but he arrived at this for his own reasons, and he found somebody with similar interests, a woman who had been in male-dominated fields in some parts of her life, and mm-hmm. she'd arrived at this for other reasons. And they're really asking the question, like, why is it that by the time you hit college, and some would argue much earlier, by the time you hit blank age, why is it that men are more predisposed mm-hmm. then? We're not asking about nature over nurture, any of that nonsense.
Right.
We're asking about what is it about how we're treating and either encouraging or discouraging activities that lend themselves to the computer science mind. Why do we do these things for boys and not for girls?
Mm-hmm.
So what I like to do personally is get involved more with educating women, minorities at a really, really young age. Mm-hmm. There are some folks doing good work on this. Somebody actually posted to the diversity SIG list on one of the Python lists about a couple who who had quit their Silicon Valley jobs and were in New York City, and they have a project they're calling Code Ed, capital C, capital E, where they're specifically targeting, I believe, junior high school age girls, and starting off with simple, we think simple things like HTML, markup, mm-hmm. and just like how to, like how this data structure turns into that thing, and then getting more into like, you know, what we'd consider light programming, like just working with JavaScript mm-hmm. in the browser, and then getting on the server side. Anyway, just introducing girls to not just using the tools, but potentially making tools. There's this, that book I mentioned, the Unlocking the Clubhouse, that there's this idea that boys invent things and girls use things that boys invent. Mm-hmm. And that that we are the tool makers, they are the artisans. Mm-hmm. And like, and we have a tradition in Western society of encouraging women to go into the arts, to be artists, to be musicians, to be, you know, like craftspersons, and that's noble somehow, and that like men who do that are like, you know, it's maybe not actively discouraged, but it's sort of like, it's kind of a namby-pamby thing to do, don't you think, dude? Mm-hmm. And it's not really seen as an appropriate path for a young man. You know, young men should be doing something more productive, like making more tools for
digging ditches.
Exactly.
Killing sheep. Yes.
It gets really silly really quickly. You know, if you try to characterize a lot of the behavior that we're engaging in that lands women and men in these roles, it does get really silly really quickly. It's like, I can't believe we're living in, you know, not even Stone Ages, pre-Stone Ages. But that's what we're still doing. And so I think a lot of the work that we need to do right now is just identifying what are these things that we're doing. So it's a lot of philosophical, thinky stuff. But I think that the tangible things that we as individuals can do is try to do personal affirmative action with the women, the young girls in your life.
Mm-hmm.
Identify them. Actively seek them out.
So kind of related to that, have you taken or do you know of anybody that's taken the angle of looking at how you can help parents encourage children?
Yeah, that's some of the work that's there's definitely work being done on that. I can't speak very well to who's doing it or what the research is, but yes, absolutely. And helping teachers especially. So one of the early examples in that book is talking about observing. It was a journal entry by a parent having watched dropping off her son at kindergarten and seeing the boys hovering around the computers before class, and the girls are all over in the book area, and they just sort of segregate themselves. Mm-hmm. And upon, like, you know, interacting with the teacher about this, like, why is this happening? And she's like, I don't know. The boys just do that, and the girls do that. I don't, you know, it's just kind of throwing your hands up. And mm-hmm. instead, trying to impose a little bit of intention, like, let's think about why these things are happening, and maybe take some action to try to encourage the opposite. Maybe, I don't know how, like, you know, how haphazard it is. For very pretty non-scientific thing to do, it's just like, just try to do something different. You know, it's like you said, your complaint is totally valid, and it's where I arrived many years ago. I was like,
sure,
this is just frustrating. I want to do something, but what do I do?
Right, and that's really, you know, speaking as a father of two daughters, one 13 and one 10, you know, I find that the biggest problem that I have is finding the reason for them to want to do this. I mean, my youngest daughter, I gave her an Edubuntu install on an old laptop because that's what we do. We install Linux on old laptops.
This is what we do in this house.
Exactly. And so she found the Logo program,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so she started programming the turtle to do these things, and she absolutely loved it. And I didn't know where to take it from there because I was like, Python. Python's like typing English. She could easily learn this. I'm going to teach her to parse an RSS feed.
Exactly. Like, what's fun?
Read log files? I mean, what do you...
She can build a Web 3.0 website.
There we go. Web 3.0. What
the hell does that mean,
it's
even?
The next thing it's after the Web 2.0.
we're looking to them.
Making 3.0.
Right.
But, so, you know, to your point, though, that's what I found really interesting about the CodeEd approach was mm-hmm. they were just trying to help these young women just mm-hmm. make a web page. Like, here's something that they can actually do, and they can, you know, giving them the ability, like showing them how to FTP their stuff up to this server that they were providing so that they could have a personal web page. Like, how much cooler is it to do that than it is to just have, like, to live within the bounds of Facebook or live within the bounds of MySpace, that they're actually, like, actively making this machine do exactly what they want. And there was a little bit explained about, like, you know, the shrill laughter that happened when they showed them how to change the CSS to go from, you know, like blue to purple on their background of their site. Like, oh my God, you know, like how awesome is that, that you can you can tell a machine what to do. And that was the tangible thing that they'd given these girls to be able to see, like, what, how they can use programming day to day to do really tangible things.
Right, and I think, you know, well,
I said tangible. We're talking about bits.
But yeah, I know that's a whole other discussion, I think. So, well, if someone wanted to know more specifically about the things within the Python community, where would they go to learn
more? The diversity SIG is a low traffic list that needs more traffic. And that, okay. There, we'll have links for that, I assume.
It is now a low traffic
list. It is now a low traffic list. I am seeking to make it a high traffic list. There are not enough people contributing to the diversity SIG. And that means special interest group, for those of you who don't know. So that needs more voices. Right now, I'm pretty sure most of the voices are people like us sitting around this table, white dudes. It's okay for now. We don't have to feel horrible about ourselves that we're all the ones part of the conversation, but we need to actively seek out other people to bring in the conversation. And that's why we need people actively on that list, at least if not to participate, to observe the conversations that have happened. There are good links being posted there all the time about, like, you know, look at the good work that's happening over here, good work happening over here. We're still trying to wrap our heads around what we can do.
Right. Where do you begin?
Well, yeah.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. And if people want to find you, where can they find you?
I'm Meatball Hat.
Meatball Hat?
Yeah.
Okay, everywhere.
That's my internet self.
All right. Thanks much.
Yay.
Yeah, the whole diversity topic is tricky, I think. Again, I signed up for the Python, the diversity list, and yes, you were right. It is a very, very slow list, and I think it seems like we don't know how to do what we want to do. Does it make a lot of sense?
It's true. Yeah, the problem is it's hard to start thinking about it because it's really huge, and we're talking about, like, somebody arriving at some place in their late teens and early 20s that they've been building up to their entire life. And so, like, how do you begin tackling that issue with your coworkers or people who are interns or whatever? So it is really huge, but for those of us here, and I'm not among them, who have daughters, and I think there's at least four of you here who have daughters, I mean, the point is to start really early with exposure and home internships with them, you know, just having your stuff out at the table and doing your stuff and assuming that, well, of course you would want to see me do this. Of course you would want to watch with me while I'm messing around with stuff. Of course you would want to sit at the keyboard and have me show her how to do something. Mm-hmm. And I can't say too much about that because I only have a son and he's only two, and right now he's still in the key mashing, so I haven't quite reached that stage with him yet. But it has a lot more to do with assuming that of course they would want to. Mm-hmm. And if you start from there, then the likelihood of having those at-home experiences where they're just going to be exposed to it, or in school, just being exposed to it, increasing the likelihood of that is going to lead them on a path toward where that's even an option. Whereas in most cases, we just assume that girls, like, well, you know, because they're not the one going over to the computer right away as soon as they're able, they're not the one spending all their free time on it. We just assume that they're not as into it as the guys are. And in reality, that's happening. That separation is happening. That gap is happening because the boys are hogging it, and we're not actively trying to make sure that the girls have a chance.
Okay, I can see that. That makes some sense.
And this is right now we're just talking about diversity in terms of gender gap. I mean, there's a much bigger issue in socioeconomic gap and ethnicity gap, but it's a huge thing. So it's kind of hard to talk about. And I guess the point that I wanted to get across with any talk of it at all is let's stop thinking about it in terms of guilt. And think about it in terms of increasing code quality. Because you're only going to have high-quality software if you have a diverse set of inputs.
I think that's a perfectly fair point. And my daughters are 10 and 13 at this point. And my younger daughter was playing around with Logo and was rather enjoying it. And I think that if I could find a reason for her to do it... See, I got into programming because I wanted to make the computer do things. And I think that's really what it came down to. I didn't even have a firm use. I just wanted to make the computer do things. And what I'm wondering, and this is a generational thing.
What was your hardware? Was that like a Commodore 64?
Baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Similar experience to Apple II.
All right. Yeah.
And it was hardware that you could very easily do that. There was such a low barrier to entry.
Well, right, and the manual came right with the box, and you know you had everything there. You know, it was all basic, at least for me. So, you know, I wanted to find something that made D&D characters for me. Because I got tired of rolling them off. All good programmers are lazy programmers. They only want to do things once. So, but, you know, I sit and I look at the way my children use computers now. And it's... They have lots of programs that do things for them. You know, like managing your music library. They has the iTunes for this.
It's the problem is already solved problem.
Yeah, exactly.
This is what's discouraging computer science enrollment too.
Right,
we feel
right.
Like everything's already so complex, like, well, that thing might have been a problem 10 years ago, but somebody already solved it, so why should I care?
Right. Right. And it's so you know, I guess it's the sort of thing that I would love to see them get involved. I'd love to see them take an interest. But right now it's just the black magic that Dad does. You know, when he's sitting in front of his computer. So maybe, you know, that's just a good place to start the discussion on the list to say, hey, you know, how have other people approached this?
Do your daughters use a computer?
They use it for email. They use it for playing The Sims. They use it for syncing their iPods. But they're not, and they use it for watching videos.
Now, you know what you can do is you could remove the GUI and force them to use, like,
just
Pine and Ursi. And...
Well, so my kids are, I mean, they're not in that boat directly, but we don't have Windows in our house, so we don't have any Apple products in our house. They have to use stuff that is open source, just by what I agree with. And so they kind of have to learn some more stuff that I think other kids don't have to learn because of that. Everybody else considers that a bad thing. I consider that a good thing.
But I think that's good, though, because, like, what are the things that motivated us? Like, playing games, MUDs, and things like that.
Well, yeah, you know, I loved Zork. Zork got me hooked. I tried to write my own in BASIC and realized it was a lot harder than it looked. You know, but it was, I mean, I think a large part of it was we lived in a world of text when we were coming of age, and graphics were interesting, and you could do them, but they were never terribly realistic. The idea of... I was recently contacted by a 19-year-old guy who wants to get into game design and game programming. And I was somewhat ashamed to admit that I'm not exactly sure where to start with that now. Because it's a very, very complex area these days.
There are formal programs you can go to. My cousin went to a game development school and is now doing like hardcore console development stuff.
He's
really good at it.
And that's pretty cool. I've got to tell this guy about that. But it was, again, you know, I don't want to get into the, things were different when I was a kid sort of talk. But I remember I was listening to A Shot of Jack not long ago. And John O'Bacon and Stuart Langridge were talking about the same thing, that, you know, the manuals don't come with the box anymore. And even when you get a Linux install, you know, there's a gap there to learn to do what you want to do to make the OS do what you want it to do.
Boy, but a lot of that is English motivation, too. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, probably one of the most interesting experiences I had as a kid, I don't know, I was probably 13, is, downloading Gen 2, burning it to a CD, and then just sitting there and pounding against a stage 1 install on really old hardware until I figured out, you know, how the hell does this work? And you learn so much, and at that age, it's like, well, like, you know, this is kind of fun, so...
Well, yeah, but what makes you want to do that in the first place? What makes you even think that you're capable of getting through it to the point where you'd even consider taking it on? I mean, something told you were capable, otherwise you wouldn't have taken it on.
Well, hubris is one of the virtues.
Yes.
Yes.
True. Well, at that point, I had an old computer. It was an old gateway computer I'd had for a long time, just sitting in my room doing nothing. It was too slow to run, Windows, which, unfortunately, I was still using at that point in my life. And it, you know, wasn't a Mac, so what the hell do you do with that? And getting Gen 2, and I saw Gen 2 somehow, I forget how, but it's like, okay, why not? I've got this useless hunk of metal, and I have this magical disk, and it's a bunch of documentation. Might as well turn it into something useful, right?
So I feel old now, because you said you had a disk.
Yeah. I know. I remember doing, it was a Red Hat install on an old DEC Alpha.
Uh-huh. That was my...
Yeah.
And I think
yeah.
We pre-Red Hat, my first one was, I think, Slackware on a Deck Alpha. And I remember a stack of disks, probably about 18 inches high, one at a time, just literally, like, untarring things into the right place.
Oh, yeah.
So all of us right here, it's full disclosure, we're all white males.
Yes.
We're talking about six of us in glasses. Talking about diversity.
It'd be so nice if we had a female here.
Yeah. And right now we're all, I mean, we're reminiscing about, you know, early experiences we had with something, but honestly, I really believe that none of us would have even tried that if we didn't already have the foundation of confidence to think of doing something like that. And a lot of it had to do with early exposure and early, you know, early home internships is what they call it. I see what you mean.
Also, I mean, my dad worked for NASA, so I was around computers.
Yeah, predisposed.
It's like, boom, there it is.
Mike's parents are programmers.
There you go.
I mean, to your point, I mean, one of my first experiences with a computer as, like, a 3 or 4 year old was, like, sitting on my mom's lap, hacking around with batch scripts in DOS. But after that point, there was a point where, you know, mom was busy doing other things, and it's just like, okay, well, I've done a little bit of this, so just keep hacking and hacking.
Yeah, but if you've been doing it since you were 3 or 4, then you've already got a foundation of confidence.
But I think you have to do that. I mean, exactly what you're saying is, you know, get your kids involved, and even if they don't fully understand what's going on, just, you know, kind of hack with them.
It's influence. And my granddad was a tinker carpenter type, and that got me into wanting to tear things apart and build them back up and, you know, see how they tick. And I think that's kind of the attitude to have with your children. And that's what I try to do. I tried to get my son to hack a Linux box. I set up time restrictions on it so he could only be on GNOME for 2 hours at a time. And I told him if he could figure out how to hack it and break it, I wouldn't leave the restrictions on. Unfortunately, he never did, but he did actually figure out how to open the terminal and try to get it around in there. But
It was the same kind of thing I had. I have time limits on my kids' stuff.
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, I told them, if you can find a way around it, more power to you.
That's a way to get yourself rooted.
They found a way, but it was more through social engineering. They took over their little brothers who doesn't have them. You know. But I think the point that I find most interesting is that the thing that we've consistently got here is that it was never a toaster to us.
Right.
Yeah, de-toasterizing the computer is what makes people interested in it.
Yep.
And getting your daughters in front of it so that they don't look at it and go, oh, it's a pretty box just to get email on. No, it's powerful. You can do things with it.
Well, I think part of it, too, is just being a jerk. I know if you talk to my dad now, he'll recount stories of, like, I just go grab a screwdriver and start taking shit apart. Yeah. So I'm interested in what's inside the computer. I'm going to go find a screwdriver and take it apart.
Right.
I was actually actively discouraged not to do that, or encouraged not to do that, but you just got to be a jerk.
Yeah.
But that takes confidence.
It does.
And
it does.
You don't have that.
Girls are going to be less likely to be jerks.
Well, they're going to be less likely to take that step if they've already been brought up to identify that thing as a boy thing. And it's like whether we know we're doing it or not, that happens a lot. Where you just assume that, like, well, she must not be that into it because, well, I look over here and there's a boy her age who's like crazy into it. So, you know, that probably happened because who was working on it most, mom or dad?
You know, that's actually a very good point. I didn't realize until I was thinking about it, but whenever there's a computer problem in the house,
who gets called upon?
It's dad. Call dad. That'll
whenever fix there's
it.
Any electronic problem in the house.
Yeah, but that leads into a much bigger thing.
That's a good point, though. That's why you don't see a lot of plumbers and electricians.
You know, see, my wife is very much an exception to that rule. She's the one that does the work on the cars. Mm-hmm. She does a lot of the you know, carpentry stuff around the house because she really enjoys it. And the girls are into that now, but the computer is still very much the thing of, oh,
yeah,
God, I don't want
to
mess it up.
Identifying with which parent. And
right.
Know, like, kids start doing this at like 3 years of age. They start trying to sort out, like, what is my identity? And, like, who are my role models and what are they doing? And how can I fall into one category or another so I understand what my bounds are?
Sure.
And that's crazy early when this stuff starts.
All right. Well, we're going to take... This is our last break. We're going to just... I think we're just going to finish out with your interview with Greg, who... What was Greg's last name?
Greg Malcolm.
Yes, Greg Malcolm, who did the Python Cohen's talk,
yeah.
And I know you guys kind of ramble a bit. Our episode is running long, so we'll just tie it up right after.
It's value added.
It's value added. There it is. So we're here with
with Greg Malcolm, who's working on Python Collins.
Hi there.
Hi, Greg. So what is Python Collins?
Python Collins. It's basically a set of unit tests which test Python. So normally you'd write it to test the program you're writing. You'd write tests as you go along, prove it works. In this case, the program's rewritten, it's on Python, and all the tests are broken. So it's more of a maintenance thing.
Ah, so it's... Are they broken in a specific way, or...?
Yeah, they start with the most simple aspects, certs, and work on to none, strings, and all the aspects of Python.
Okay.
So basically you go through, fix the test, you'll pretty much learn the whole of Python as you go through it.
So it's like a practical introduction to the language.
Yes, very much so. Very entry level.
What made you start working on these?
I'm a big fan of Ruby Collins. Something I discovered at CodeMash, or at least heard about CodeMash and went home and tried. I've gone through that a couple of times. And then I was having a conversation with a friend of mine who... I'm more from background of Ruby, C++, you name it. And I've got a friend who's really into Python. And we're sitting down, it's like, show me some Ruby. Okay, well, here's Ruby Collins, go through that.
Ah.
Okay, I'll do some Python at the same time. And it's like, okay, what should I do? I know. By now, they must have made something for the Python side of things. Search for it, and there were some started Python Collins. So it ended up just for fun, converting over what was left.
So how deep down the language do you go? You said you start simple with basic strings and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like a grand finale, or?
It definitely gets... as you go along, various stages, there are sets of exercises where instead of making tests pass, you're actually writing the tests are fine, but you've got to write the code to make the test pass. So it kind of starts with one about triangles where it's got tests to confirm scenarios where you have an equilateral triangle and isosceles and everything, but you've got to write the actual... actually got to write the code. So by the time it gets to the end, I think it pretty much finishes with a big exercise.
So it's all about kind of getting you going, and mm-hmm. ultimately you're kind of on your own, no bumpers.
Yeah, pretty much.
So have you tried this out with anybody, or how does it work with people? Like I guess maybe a better question would be, how would you use this to maybe kind of get somebody into Python, or kind of help them teach or help teach someone?
Well, I suppose the nice thing is you can just typically download it from Bitbucket or GitHub.
Okay.
So or just check out the code.
And we'll put that link in the show notes too.
Yeah, and once you got that, you're pretty much set to run, because you just run one Python script, contemplate Collins, and suddenly you've got a bunch of fails.
It sounds very zen.
Including the cursing.
So when someone's going through this, then they're you start off pretty simple, and a lot of the code's provided for you then?
So it's pretty self-sufficient. Behind the scenes, it's using unit test, which is built into Python already.
Okay.
So it just, I've kind of written some code that horribly mangles it and turns it into something that sounds Zen-like, basically to match what was in Ruby Collins.
Ah.
So something like, your karma has been destroyed because this test failed.
So, but you can eventually build back up to full karma.
I also couldn't resist throwing the Zen of Python in at the end, because in the old Ruby Collins, it used to say something Zen-like at the bottom, like, mountains are only mountains, or whatever. So it's like, Python, there's a Zen of Python, so I had to throw that in.
So that's like, just like no C, you don't have to do any C?
C in Python? No, there's no C.
So it's not like you have to write unit tests against the C code?
So you're thinking literally because there's some C in native code in Python.
Yeah.
Well, so it's it's not really about interpreter internals kind of coding. It's more of a...
Yeah, I should probably rephrase. It's not literally a test that prove Python works. It's more tests that cover the language semantics. So initially, it's just proving... For example, with none, we'd be doing a bunch of things like comparing none to another object... say is instance none object, so they were comparing that to something called underscore underscore, which when you run it as a test, it will actually turn to fill me in. It's kind of it doesn't really do anything as complex as telling you how the compiler's working, really, just the semantics.
Now, is it something that anyone here who's at PyOhio can kind of go to your session and where you walk people through actually getting up and running with the colons? Is it something that somebody can just download, not really knowing anything about Python, and get jump started into?
Yeah, definitely, it's great for that. It's probably going to be one or two stumbling blocks, but once you get past them, I think it's good. Yeah, there's definitely one, I think, in about none, where it was kind of comparing the results of an exception to fill me in, and a lot of people getting confused by that. But I think what I've shown is, like, just look at the results, look what we're saying on the actual compiler error, which is basically attribute error equals fill me in, and actually getting across them, look, the little quotes around it. You've got to get those quotes in there.
So it's something then that if you kind of take it slowly and work through it and really read the error messages and kind of get to you can achieve some Python enlightenment.
That's right. I mean, certainly I know it from the other end with the Ruby Cohens, and I learned Ruby that way, and kind of learned Python that way as well, because it was teaching me Python by doing this.
It's amazing how much you kind of learn from those just by kind of researching and doing that stuff. Mm-hmm. The Ruby Cohens, I noticed kind of playing with those in the past, there's a lot of really interesting things where you find out about some corner case in the language or some maybe non-obvious semantics of Ruby just by kind of exercising the Cohens. Mm-hmm. Were you able to find anything in Python that was kind of weird and edge casey that maybe would surprise people?
Definitely. I just promise I'm trying to remember this now.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Yeah, I guess, unfortunately, I can't remember. But I had a few surprises.
there's always those edge cases, no matter what your language is.
Yeah, I think the trickiest bit for me was later on, there's a part of Ruby that is quite different to Python, where they're testing the message parsing. Mm. Every class in Ruby kind of... You can send a message kind of like the old small talk way of doing things.
Yeah.
And changing that to Python, I had to go around a lot of corners to make that work. I had to get the hang of the whole get attra, set attra type stuff.
Oh, so you even dipped down into kind of some of the magic functions.
Yeah. So basically getting to some of the Python magic. And at the time, so that was kicking my ass a bit when I was learning figuring it out. Because you get... It's kind of equivalent stuff in Ruby, but when I got it wrong in Python, I just have horrible stack trace problems. And I was thinking, how the hell am I going to get that across without the person doing it getting frustrated?
Yeah.
That was a challenge.
But you, it seems like you made it through it, because and I think those are valuable lessons too, because anybody who's new to Python can kind of see all these double underscore methods all over the place and get totally confused. So some kind of nice intro is helpful for that.
Yeah, well, other things, I end up converting it for Python 3 as well. So,
oh, did you?
So that's kind of, could be useful for people who know Python, actually trying to figure out what's different in Python 3.
So as someone who is a Python 2 guy mostly, kind of trying to progress towards 3, are there things that you learned that kind of helped maybe make Python 3 a little bit easier to understand?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the things is there's a lot of backwards compatibility features, like the whole types and classes thing. Because I mean, one of the things I kind of found out the hard way is how you have to always make a class inherit from object.
Yeah.
And I think I only got caught onto that one because my Pythonista friend kind of alerted me to that one early, so I didn't fall into that trap too much. But, of course, you could go to 3, suddenly you'll see that the object part's missing, so that might be a surprise to some people.
There's a lot of stuff in 3.
A lot of other things as well. Yeah. That's just more of the biggies, I think. Because it just suddenly gets a lot cleaner.
And do you go into anything about maybe some of the changes, the string Unicode or bytes Unicode? Any of the... I guess so much change in Python 3, yeah. it's even hard to...
I didn't really touch that aspect. I think there might have been... I can't remember if it had anything to do with the older dictionaries or anything like that, but... I think there's some issues with iterators. I think iterators changed a lot. So there's, yeah. I think that might be one of those edge case things, really. So There's probably some big differences that on between the Python 2 side of the fence and Python 3 side. Okay. Although I'm tempted to update for Python 2.7 now because I just fixed a bug with it last night, very late hour. But I was looking through, and it looks like some of the Python 3 niceness has seeped through to Python 2 now.
Yeah, it seems like they're kind of backporting some of that stuff, but at least to a point. So it's good to see that there's some kind of introduction. I know a lot of people seem to have trouble with Python 3 and understand, like really wrapping your brain around it.
Mm.
And the fact that you have a nice tutorial to it is very cool. Any final thoughts?
Well, aside from Python cones, there's also seems to be a lot of other cone projects sprouting up, and that's kind of exciting.
For other languages
other features. I mean, the whole concept of that actually caused Ruby cones to come about in the first place is, I think there's just a number of people saying, well, a great way to language is to write tests, exploratory tests first on your API, and I think people doing bits and bobs of what Ruby cones is, and I think it just took till Ruby cones for it to catch everyone's imagination. But since that's happening, a lot of, certainly searching on the GitHub side of things, you find a lot of different projects calling themselves cones now. There's a .NET cones. I think they kind of, that's another one a bit like Python cones. They've probably got about half of that done, maybe.
Okay.
But they start to get more original with them now, though. There's one that's getting really popular called MongoDB cones.
Oh, really?
That's Ruby-based, but it's more about teaching about Mongo, but that seems to be looking very popular. There's a lot of people were following that project, more than Python cones, certainly.
Well, the Python cones are pretty new, too. Is Python cones a finished project? Is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It works completely, although I do worry about what happens when new Python versions come out. I got caught out last night by the 2.7.1 because I checked it at the last minute and it broke. When I went at this test run, I did some horrible things to unit test.
Some monkey patching?
Oh, yeah, something along those lines, yeah. I did the runner before I actually did Python cones, so my knowledge of Python was minimal at that stage, and I kind of overrode a class called underscore write ln decorator, which is in unit test.
Oh.
And of course, I know now that underscore means private. And funny enough, it went away in 2.7.
Oops,
so suddenly the code was broken. But I don't know. Sometimes it's okay, I think, to write bad code as long as you learn from it.
It's all about the learning experience, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's very cool that you've got this project, and I really hope that more Python people could kind of get on board and maybe help bring other people into the language.
Mm-hmm.
So you gave the presentation here today. How did that go? Did you see a lot of excited people understanding Python?
Yeah, it's the second time I've done this now because I tried this last month, about a month or two back with my local user group. And of course, you know, this was kind of lead up to today, and I had this plan all set. I was going to start with a 15-minute talk on test-driven development and how it applies to Python cones with a demonstration on screen. And, of course, with all best-laid plans, it didn't happen that way because it took about half an hour for the rejector to get up and running. So that was kind of fun because I was running around like a maniac. I mean, I could still work, but I had to run around like a maniac trying to get through to people. Like, it's not an installation. You have to copy the code off the CD and use this console here to run the commands. And
the
I had an assistant, fortunately, which helped. So about halfway in, I finally gave this presentation. And it was just like, yeah, this is going to look familiar too. This is how you use Python cones. Yeah, you've seen this before, haven't you?
Well, it was a hands-on presentation.
It was, yeah. I think that worked out well, because, you know, if that had been a talking presentation, that might have been a problem.
Well, I've heard some good stuff in the hall about it, people liking it, and I'm glad it was well-received.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking some time to chat with us. It was good to meet you, and great to hear about the project.
Yeah.
And now, for the benefit of next year's PyOhio Planning Committee, improvements that we think could be made. Dave.
More talks.
Same
span.
Oh, same space?
Same space.
Same space, what does that mean?
Like the venue we were in was...
Oh, where we were, the Ohio Union.
Yes.
All right, Dan.
More lab-like talks with lots of tables and power.
More sprints that aren't necessarily about core development. Mike.
More brownies.
Things that can convince my family that they should let me go.
Nice. Improve seating situation in the round room. I think that's already been brought up.
Lack of round room. Just kill
or
it.
Just,
just get rid of it. More, yeah, classroom style is good.
Yeah.
Better spaces to just chill and hack in the union.
Which may be a reuse for the round room.
Good point.
Huh? Mm.
Good.
Keep the logo. I really liked it.
Yeah, the guy that made the logo has never been.
Anything else?
More. What the hell is this?
Coffee all day.
Coffee
yes.
all day. Coffee all day.
Bigger yes. coffee mugs.
Starting at noon on Sunday is an awesome idea.
Yes, that was a great idea.
It was a good idea,
especially for some of us.
More publicizing in the immediate Columbus area mm-hmm. prior to, because there are some guys that I talked to, guys I do mean men I talked to who came there at the last minute. Like I had no idea this thing was happening until like a couple days ago, mm-hmm. and they were very passive Python users, and so just reach those students especially. Who are right there in Columbus.
More sponsorships. I think
yeah,
that
yeah.
seeing more of what's out there. I mean, don't get me wrong. We had the bags that came from the leftover bags of PyCon that came, and that's great. Don't get me wrong. But it'd be interesting to see if we can get Ohio sponsors for PyOhio.
You don't like leftovers?
No, it's not that.
It's okay for a free conference.
Sponsors.
Yes. It's okay.
Yes, I just think that sponsors are a good thing.
I think they should charge for the conference. Even if it's
Ooh,
not
even
much.
If it's little, even if it's not much, I agree.
Yeah. On the theory that you get what you pay for.
Yes.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think what.
Well, we're talking 20 bucks.
I would throw down 20 bucks.
If you
want to
charge
20
or
30
bucks, I mean that's enough to feed everybody.
Yeah, 20 bucks to travel 90 minutes for 2 days of talks.
It's actually not at Ohio Union.
Oh yeah, it's really expensive.
But yeah, 20 or 30 bucks, I would be happy to throw that down
mm-hmm.
without
yeah.
the conference.
Can we do if we did that? I love one of the things I love about OSCON was the badges that came with your name tag, or like they had like you know had your own ribbon badge, and so there were like you know especially specific areas of interest.
Oh God, like the role playing conventions.
Pretty much exactly
yeah.
yes, exactly that. Yes. So like,
sorry, go.
No, just
the ribbons. You want?
Yeah, I don't
you
know.
Want just you want personal tags.
I want
flair.
Tags. I really like the flair. I really
flair
did like
flair.
Flair. Yeah.
Well, why don't we just go all out and just do buttons? I would like.
I'm down with buttons too. Whatever's cheaper.
Can they blink? Lights on.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, sure. And your Wi-Fi signal indicator. One other thing, speaker feedback like they do at PyCon with the buckets.
Absolutely,
I think that was
yeah.
brought up, but I think that's
yeah.
much needed.
Yeah, that's,
oh, I love that.
Speaker feedback.
PyCon.
And maybe even, like, never mind. No. maybe some speaker suggestions, like, for how to get, like, I don't know, this is my first real talk in front of more than five people. So, I don't know. That would be kind of cool, like, if Dave could maybe throw a email.
I think
speakers.
They did that. Didn't they do that at PyCon where they had like a speaker?
Right.
They had
a tutorial
session or something in advance, or
I think it would be
a boff the night before the talks began
right.
or something like that.
I think a lot of us were first timers, like for larger than Klebby.
Yeah, most people that go there are first timers.
First timers.
And I think it's a great experience, but I think more feedback.
There was an informal list of Twitter and Identica IDs being kept at the main table, and I guess. If that can be formalized in any way, so
like
people,
the actual list
so
created
exactly, so that's obvious for anybody walking up to the table. Like, oh yeah, here I can just you know,
yeah.
rip this list down from maybe if it's posted on a URL or something, so you can easily grab it. I don't know what
actually
wiki page.
This is a big complaint I have of all the conferences that do open spaces is digitize that stuff. I realize the open space board is nice, but when I'm at the other end of the building and I want to know what the open spaces are and I can't log on to something to see that, really annoying.
Yeah, so maybe a little bit more IT support at the main desk, at the main table for signing up. Is
okay.
The wireless situation kind of sucked, but I understand that it's the restrictions and
what was
yeah.
the situation?
I just didn't like
guest
have
IDs
like,
or whatever.
Guest ID
yeah.
and all that. It was a little bit of a pain.
It was better than last year.
Oh, and they were blocking.
They were blocking all non-HTTP ports.
Yeah.
Well, that's well. I have SSH.
Yeah,
I know. SSH port forwarding. Whatever.
Yeah.
That was something I did the first PyCon, and I did it for my BlackBerry, and I was
okay.
so proud.
That's impressive.
And of course, we all have these ideas, so we'll all be volunteering.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
I mean, I think we're all on the organizers
right.
list.
So, yep.
Well, the funny thing is, there's more people on the organizer list than not. There's like 180 people on the list, and there's like six organizers actually have their name down.
Well, I actually asked... I need
more involvement.
I had the opportunity. I walked over to the subway with Catherine, and I asked her when she started planning, when this all starts planning.
She said now.
Right after PyCon. So you're already coming off the high for PyCon. You may as well keep it going. And
that's actually great momentum.
It really is. Yeah. Because you spent 5 days or, 10 days for some people, doing what you love. You can come right off of it and start planning the next one.
That's how the idea got started. It was right after PyCon 08, right? Actually, at PyCon 08, I think, was when the idea came about.
I don't remember.
I thought it was you and Catherine.
I think it's starting to serve as a model, because some of the guys that came from like PA and West Virginia, they mentioned I wish that we had a regional in our state capital or somewhere central for our state or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. It's nice that Powell is starting to serve as a model for that.
Well, I think it's worth saying that the suggestions we have are how to make something that's already getting better even better.
Yeah,
it's not ripping on it.
Right, not at all.
No. We don't want to give that impression.
Oh, here's what I remembered. I would like there to be more rigorous screening of talks, and I am volunteering for that.
Yeah,
because not nearly as bad as some of the ripoff talks I got at OSCON, but there were a couple where they were either mispitched, and I'm not talking about Ben's because I actually really enjoyed that one. Where they were mispitched, or the title and the abstract really didn't give you an idea. Mm-hmm. And honestly,
how do you filter those?
Do you filter those? Just having a conversation with a person. Really,
maybe the speakers should be required to submit some of their content.
Maybe
that would also motivate people to get done.
Submit the slides during or after. Mm-hmm. We've only got 3 people out of 17 that actually submitted slides.
Mine's on my website. I'll get them to you.
Exactly.
Yeah, I got it in a blog post. So yeah.
I mean, it's truly, especially like this.
Yeah.
We only actually rejected one talk, I think. Mm-hmm. And if we rejected more, we wouldn't have had a full schedule.
Sure. Right.
And it's really hard to get people motivated to, even at PyCon, I think that there's a lot of lack of getting these slides at the conference, let alone.
I don't think the slides before. I mean, because honestly, I was intimidated by that. I didn't want to have to start putting my stuff to slides until I have more information.
Sure, I think the first person that gave the slides.
That's awesome. But yeah, I guess just having a conversation with the speaker would probably tell you a lot. Like, I don't know, there was a particular talk that I'm not going to say who it was, because that's just mean, but it was like the most dry, slow, boring thing ever. And it's just,
sorry.
It was too bad. It was really too bad. It wasn't even.
Well, the other really good reason to have people submit their material in advance is incidents like there's a Ruby conference last summer that had some inappropriate sexual material that appeared in it, and obviously that hurts community diversity in a big way.
Absolutely. Yeah, sure enough.
But that could also be another model for helping filter out the talks in the long run. Accept a larger amount of talks than we need, and then filter them down based on the people that don't get their slides put in or their slides.
Well, I mean, there's a problem here, though, because you have to publicize what the talks are in the schedule to get people jazzed to actually show up.
Good point.
So
that's true.
I'll
freely admit that I think we people on the program committee didn't have a chance to. We didn't really talk enough about the process.
No.
I know myself.
Were you on the committee?
I was on the committee, and I was fairly quiet.
Like, yeah, we also didn't have enough talks to fill the schedule as
it was. Yeah, we weren't going to,
I was on the committee as well, and the idea of rejecting anything seemed silly because, we won't fill the schedule.
Well, also, maybe next year, maybe we just start with just 2 rooms. Let's make the round room a common area with some nice seating or whatever, just some chairs at all, but make the round room common so people can hang out there and only use the 2 classrooms if we're going to keep the same venue.
Maybe also an organizer, like a committee organizer stand-up at the event, like every morning. Like anybody that was involved in any way as far as the conference currently, like the session chairs, the guy at the front desk that's directing people, so that way you have an idea of what's going on in the conference as well. Mm-hmm. I think that would be helpful. So that way, everybody that's, because I kind of felt lost. I was supposed to do, supposed to be a session chair and like tell people, hey, it's time to go or whatever, or cut off. And I felt like there was a lack of kind of mesh there. Nobody really knew what the heck was going on.
As a chair, I thought you were quite comfortable.
No, thanks.
Nice. Was there somebody running that stuff specifically? Or
no, it was Catherine when she had time, and it was Catherine saying writing out numbers on pieces of paper.
Right.
Well, that highlights what someone else said earlier: is that we don't have enough volunteers.
Yes.
No,
you're right.
We've got a lot of, like, if you look at the PyCon or PyOhio.org website now, there's a list of like 15 slots for people to fill, like the audio, you know, person doing the audio, person doing the mm-hmm. website, person doing. Mm-hmm. All these things, and only like six of them are actually.
No, it's true.
Somebody.
It's true, you know. And I use the excuse that I wasn't going to do it until I got a feel for how things are going to happen, and you know, maybe that was the wrong thing to do. I thought that people were going to step up. So clearly, next year I'm going to step up and do more. Yeah, and that's exactly it. That's why
everybody thinks someone's
going
to do it.
Everybody thinks someone else is going to. Someone with more experience. Someone with this. Someone with that. I'm not involved. Maybe the only thing you can do is jump in with both feet.
I mean, I would say if you're interested in the conference at all and you're going to be there,
yeah,
sign up for something.
Yeah, I'd agree.
I mean, obviously, we don't need 150 people hovering around, but if everybody was encouraged to, you'd probably get enough.
Yeah, but if you had 150 people, there's your session chairs and your...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. That's what I mean, is that we encourage everyone to be involved in it. You're bound to have enough people.
Sponsorship's another really good one, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I called a bunch of local consulting places and no one wanted to give money.
Mm.
That was a pain in the ass, but... If you had 150 people going out and trying to find sponsorships.
Most of the consulting companies around here do PHP and .NET.
Yes. And Java.
And Java.
I was told that they don't have any... Not go over now.
Anyway.
But even Python? But, I mean, like, if you just have people that use Python at work talk to their employers.
Right.
Or go out to people they know that use Python, engage them, it's going to be beneficial.
And Catherine, her place doesn't do Python at all. It's just her, from what I understand.
I believe
that was the case, but and she still gets blessed to. I think she even got some sponsorship money from them or something. I don't know. I'd have to.
Which just goes to show, little persistence.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what's great about having Catherine up front. She's very persistent.
Right. But we can't always depend on Catherine. I think that's
right. That's
not that she's not dependable. That's not what I mean. I just mean
jerk.
Well, she does too much.
She does a lot.
Yeah.
I was just amazed at the volume of stuff she was doing. Just stunned. I'm actually somewhat ashamed of myself because I didn't raise my hand to pitch in. So,
oh, the other thing, volunteer wise, it'd be nice to have. And I didn't have to do this, so it's not me complaining about it. And I feel bad that I didn't do it now that after I look back. But when people were manning the registration chair,
mm-hmm.
right? Typically, it's going to be people from the conference of some sort that want to be in a talk, but they
right.
have to sit there at the registration desk.
Right.
And it'd be nice if there was other people that are non-techie that would be able to fit in for an hour or two, you know, throughout the day to help with
sure.
some of those non-tech stuff.
Sure.
Well, if my All wife right. goes next year, maybe I can get her out.
Thank you for joining us. We are done. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Bye. Bye-bye. Don't look like you. Monkey like you.